All right. Welcome back to another podcast episode. My name is Doug, and I'm a grateful believer in Jesus, and I am a recovering sex addict. And we are here with a special guest. I am here with Tim Mavrogeorge today of the Houston Center for Christian Counseling. And we are going to begin with our podcast episode number 7 today. So I want to welcome Tim. He is the owner of the Houston Center of Christian Counseling. And I'm going to kind of turn it over to him and let him introduce himself and kind of his background to us today.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here. And so pleased that you have taken the initiative to get these podcasts underway. And I trust that they're going to make a big difference for some men that are out there that are trying to figure out maybe what's going on in their life. And this will be a good introduction, a springboard for some men to make the first step of what they need to do to get underway. So, yes, I've been at the Houston Center for Christian Counseling since 1998 and been running, directing the practice since 2000. We have two offices in the Houston area. For people that are listening to this in the Houston area, they'll know that the area of Sugar Land and Katy, two sort of bedroom communities sitting outside of Houston directly. And anyway, we have about 40 different counselors who do all kinds of different work, and several that work specifically around the area of sexual purity / addiction issues, and several counselors that work with wives who've been struck with a lot of pain surrounding this issue. And so anyway, it's wonderful work. I love it, love doing what I do, and am enthused every day when I start my day. And even today, after a 10 or 11 hour day here at the office, and just love being here, love the opportunity to do this kind of work and end the day by doing this podcast with you. So thanks for the invite.
Well, we appreciate you taking the time to do it. I know that you're a well-known, you know, celebrity in the circles in which I run. So a lot of our groups, I know that you've brought a lot of healing to a lot of families, both the spouses and, you know, those suffering with addiction, and just looking for healing and finding help. So just, again, thank you for that, and thank you for being with us today. Just kind of wanted to start off first just talking a little bit about Christian counseling. So we're here at the Houston Center for Christian Counseling. So I just think it's important to note before we really even get into the podcast, how does Christian counseling differ from counseling? I mean, if someone's seeking out help and maybe they're not a follower of Jesus Christ, or maybe they're not a Christian, are they stopped at the door? Do you keep them from coming in? How does that work?
Yeah, we just card everybody, and we need your Christian card before you come in. No, not at all. And, you know, I really like to think that we meet people exactly where they are. Exactly is a big word, but we want to meet people where they are. And the nature of a Christian counselor, that title can have different meanings for different people. What it means here is all of our counselors are all have master's degrees, from state universities, some from Christian universities or Christian higher ed programs, and have had to go through and get all the licensures that any other therapist would be required to have. But what would distinguish a Christian counselor from my perspective would be someone who has a backdrop in their mind of a worldview that has integrated and thought about the scripture, the Bible, as a backdrop for life, as looking at life through that lens, and has a relationship with Christ, and what all that means. Sometimes, you know, in a counseling office, it's maybe something as opening and closing with prayer. Sometimes it's opening the Bible and looking at that. Sometimes it's doing some significant trauma work. In my world, that might mean doing some EMDR work for some people who know what that means. But doing, you know, it's a variety of things. It's taking all the best of what traditional therapy has to offer and having a worldview that all of it is fit into the backdrop of what Scripture also has to say about us and our dignity and being image bearers, bearing the image of God and what that means, and living within that that set of parameters, and knowing that that's good and that's right, and that's where we find joy and contentment in life.
Awesome. And I kind of ask you that loaded question intentionally. I think it parallels what this podcast does. We are, you know, Castimony is a Christian-based organization that looks through the 12 steps through that lens of Christianity, but by no means is that a requirement. Just like coming here would be not a requirement for anybody that's seeking counseling, that the goal is true healing, but it's going to be looked through that lens of Christ and seeing how to focus on the cross. In talking with Tim kind of before this was getting started, I told him I wanted to tell a story about a Saturday Night Live with Bob Newhart. I'd ask him if he'd ever seen it, and he said, I'm a counselor. I've probably seen it 100 times. But for those of you that may not be counselors, I'll explain the setup pretty quickly here. But I think it was on Saturday Night Live. Bob Newhart had a thing where it was $5 therapy. So I remember this lady came in, and she was like, is this for real? Just going to be $5? And he was like, yeah, absolutely. And so he said, you know, pay me $5. And so she handed him a $5 bill, and she said, well, I'm really anxious about this with my mother. And she started to try to explain, and he stopped her, and he said, okay, I got it. I can cure you now. And she was like, what? And he said, just stop it. And she was like, what? And he said, just stop being anxious. Just stop it. And so for every ailment that kept coming up, he would just stop the person and say, just stop it. That was his therapy. That was his advice for every single thing. And I think for a lot of us that are in therapy, that are in recovery, that are in addiction, that's a real common stereotype that's out there. I can't tell you how many times I've heard from people, why didn't he just stop? Or why didn't he just stop? He knew it was wrong all along. And so kind of to springboard our discussion today, I really just kind of want to open with that thought of why can't an addict or someone that's struggling with secret sin or some of these things that are in our past and in the dark, why can't we just stop it?
Yeah, great question. And it was a funny Bob Newhart, especially when she pulls out her pad and pencil and she's going to begin taking notes. And he just says, you won't need that. What I have to say is very straightforward and simple. And she sets it down. She's pretty disheartened that she doesn't have more information to take down. But yeah, I mean, it's a great question. It's a question of why is it that addiction it becomes such an issue that a person, as one psychologist calls it, the loss of felt choice. That is the loss of felt choice. You feel as if you don't have a choice, that there's a sense where a person gets caught up in whatever their addiction is, and this is about sexual addiction, and that what we've struggle with for years, especially within the church, is trying to distinguish, is it sin? Is it addiction? And as if there's some radical difference between those two. And we know that anything that misses God's ultimate design and purpose of how he designed us to be is sin. But it calling it just that is not enough to resolve this, is not enough to rectify it. And what we learn is that there are just a number of facets to addiction that cultivate or create a sense of why people cannot stop an addiction. And that is the multi-level elements that it captures. One is the emotional element, that when many people that have been looking, say, at pornography since they were young teens, sometimes very young children, and they've developed this emotional bonding with an emotional attachment with something. It doesn't matter what it is. And if it's pornography, that is what the mind will gravitate toward. We would like to think that somebody would become a Christian and this would go away. But the reality is it just simply does not. Not until a person develops healthy attachments.
So is that where the felt choice idea comes from? Is that you think, okay, by circumstances, it's going to get rid of this. If I get married, I'm not going to be a sex addict anymore. But instead, you gravitate right back to what you feel like you can't control or get away from.
That's correct. And the nature of that being where people, that's why they get set up in what we call, geographical cures. People think if I just change, you know, where I live, or yeah, I'll just change from being single to married. It'll just make this thing go away. And what we know is it doesn't, and oftentimes can increase it, exacerbate it.
So does it help to view it, I'm not saying view it like a disease as an excuse, like I can't control it, it's a disease. But does it help to view it in that lens to say it's more of a, like treatable like a disease where it's going to be consistent and have some characteristics, or is there another way to view it?
You know, looking at it as a disease is something that if you apply certain things to it, it actually gets better. Because, you know, another element to this that we understand more now than ever is the brain physiology behind addiction and the nature of addiction that has just become clearer to us now than ever because of the incredible brain scans that go on, that we can see elements that in a person's brain of how it actually can manifest in brain physiology. And especially if when trauma and pain and childhood abuse is wrapped up with this with the addiction, because many, many people are stuck in addiction because of how early on a child learned how to self-medicate because of abuse, and the immense statistics that have been shown. Patrick Carnes, who's kind of the grandfather of, in this field, he wrote a tremendous book several years ago called Don't Call It Love, and it came out of some research that he did at the treatment center he was working at the time. And there's a lot to say about this book. It's very dense. There's a lot of tremendous things that he reports in it, but you know, the statistics were very compelling that, you know, that 97% of men and women that went through this treatment center to deal with sexual addiction dealt with emotional abuse. 97%, 81% dealt with sexual abuse, and 72% dealt with physical abuse. So those are very compelling numbers that when you look at people that get stuck in addiction, how much abuse is surrounding that. And I'll just tell you right up front, most people that are listening to this will say, well, I don't relate to that, because what I've learned about the nature of abuse is most people don't even recognize that they've experienced it.
So how can they not know they're abused? And I'm almost saying this tongue in cheek, because as one in recovery, I was saying the same thing. Since I remember someone digging in, a counselor's digging in, saying, we have to find where there's some abuse in there, and saying, I know there was no physical abuse. This isn't denial. And I know that happens. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people can lock it away so tightly that they just don't remember it. But there's so many facets of what abuse is that's where you start to realize, oh, that's where it's coming from. At least for me, that's where it was.
Exactly. That there is the word facets. There's so many facets to abuse. And that when people are not aware of what kind of abuse that they've experienced. I'm struck by a story that Dan Allender, who wrote a book called The Wounded Heart, and it's one of the most intense and best books on sexual abuse that's ever been written. Dan Allender called The Wounded Heart. And he said he was struck by this phenomenon. I will just tell you that he is one of the most brilliant men that I've ever heard. And he said that he was in the midst of writing his book as a therapist. And when he was confronted with the reality of someone running his own criteria by him, he still resisted believing that he was an abuse victim. And when the person finally said, look, you're a man of integrity, in so many words, I'm paraphrasing it, if you use your own criteria, you are an abuse victim. And he finally had to come to grips with it in the midst of writing a book on sexual abuse.
Oh, man. Powerful.
Yeah. So anyway, what we know is, why is it that somebody can't say no? Why is it that no is just not enough, especially if you're a Christ follower and this high calling, and we want to believe that it just should supernaturally change our desire, our wanter, as I like to call it. The things that we want, that they should just be different. And the reality is that when abuse is a part of our background, and it is like an app in your back in your phone. It's like you don't recognize, why does my phone keep going dead? And finally you look and you realize you've got an app that's running all the time and your battery is just draining all the time. And that's kind of how abuse will operate. It's like an app that's running in the background all the time and you don't even understand why the phone keeps dying. And that's the energy depleter that it is in our life. And so the ability to just can't say no, it may work well for prevention and it can be helpful in that regard. But once someone's addicted and it has set up itself as both an emotional soother, it's a physiological brain mechanism that our brain has completely defaults towards. And then the things that we know in the spiritual realm that take place, that as scripture says, and this is one of those things that as a Christian counselor, we would take into account that there is, as scripture talks about, that we have a battle with the world, the flesh, and the devil, and that we have three compelling things that are always at us and always nipping at our heels. And so as Christians, we're struggling with those. And we just, as Christians, we recognize that there are three things that are constantly nipping at us and will constantly tempt us to get us to come back into that cycle.
So there's just this constant tug and pull that's going on. And I like that analogy of the wanter. I've never heard that before. But because I sat in church many times and sat on my own many times in my own addiction, trying to say, I want something better. I want what's out there. Obviously, I know that the things I was doing were wrong. It wasn't somebody just needs to show me, hey, what you're doing is wrong. I absolutely knew that already. And so I did have a big wanter. I wanted to get out of that and just felt like there was always something pulling back in. And I think what you were talking about the app makes a lot of sense about that really depleting the energy and that there's something pulling on us that we don't even recognize. Now, I think that app should get a pretty bad rating in the iTunes store if it was there. But knowing that our emotions that we're having now are almost always tied back to circumstances that have happened before. Yes. And so that kind of leads me into my next thought or question is that so many times on my own, I wanted change. I wanted something new. And I made promises. I made deals with God. I made deals with myself that I would change this and do this differently. Over and over and over. And I couldn't do it on my own. So I found recovery help in finding, help with a counselor, help with groups that I'm in. Is recovery possible alone?
Let me give a long thought to that. No.
All right. That's like $5 therapy.
Yeah,
right there.
Yeah. There you go. Pull out your pad. No, don't do it. Stop it, right? The reality is this, is that many people, especially when I speak with men that are in ministry, that are trying, and there's a sense of shame that they should be beyond this and they shouldn't have to deal with this. There's such a yearning and a desire to be able to pull this off and do it alone. And I can just say, even 20 years ago when I was really first engaging in sexual addiction counseling, and that I sort of bought into that at times, like, yeah, you are a pastor of a large church and I can see why that would be difficult. And I watched these men never, ever get traction. And it is amazing once men step into the community of other people and several factors that start transpiring with a man telling his story is all of a sudden this exposure of shame that has just been such a compelling piece of this starts depleting. And the shame starts going away and how recovery can really gain some traction when that takes place.
So I think that's one of the things we need to explore is how that shame really does have a factor in the cycle. But I want to push the pause button on that track just real quick and think back to, 20 years ago, you said that's when you got into, more of this sex addiction. Is there something that was, why 20 years ago? And again, I'm kind of leading with this question intentionally, but what happened 20 years ago that made sex addiction more prevalent?
Well, I can tell you that with the onset of the internet, it was like somebody turned a switch on and, there's no turning back. And when that happened, it was like my phone lit up and every other phone call had to deal with asking if I did work around this realm, because it became so replete with so many requests and all the different ways that this started manifesting, and just ways that nobody ever imagined. Somebody had written something several years back. I think it was a gentleman out of California, and he talked about the AAA engine, and he talked about the affordability, the accessibility, and the anonymity, and that the AAA engine, again, any one of those, the affordability, the fact is that you can look at a whole lot of pornography, and it's very affordable because it's free. It, the accessibility, and that is we're only two or three clicks away at any moment from just a world that used to be just unfeasible.
We carry it in our pocket.
Yeah. And then the anonymity of it, where it can, you can be by yourself. And so, I mean, there are three things. Everybody knows that. But, you know, that just that AAA engine image for me was always helpful to realize this is why it is so powerful. Again, Patrick Carnes talked about it, that I heard him in a presentation say that it was like when the internet came on, it was like the crack cocaine of sexual addiction. And I heard him say that what used to take 2 years to create a sexual addiction could be done in 3 months with the onset of the internet because of this AAA engine.
Yeah, it was completely a game changer. And I do think that's what I tied into when you said 20 years ago. So I thought it was worth going back into and looking at that. Because I had heard that same quote that the internet was to pornography like crack was to the drug world. It was a game changer. And I think, unfortunately, there are so many tentacles in our culture that the dark one, the evil one, has his tentacles around so many people. And so I think being real about that, knowing that the three A's are driving that, really jumping back into that cycle of thought where we were earlier, where we hit pause and talking about keeping people trapped in their own shame and as an individual. And we talked about you can't walk that road alone. And so kind of talk about that shame and how that would propel an addict or someone that's struggling with pornography or struggling with affairs or strip clubs or massage parlors, would propel them into this lifestyle that they already know is wrong.
Well, so, you know, the nature of the shame is that as much as we know how big and how powerful and things like the internet feeds the sexual addiction, there's still a sense of shame that says that I'm alone, that I'm different, that there's something wrong and defective with what I'm doing. And that is the shame that goes with it. The shame is, you know, that I really am, that there truly is something wrong and defective with me. If anybody knew what I was really like inside, that they would recognize that there's just something very bad and defective. And the very healing of that is through something very counterintuitive. And that is, you go and step into a world of other men, of a counselor, of people, your wife at some point being a part of it, but that you expose the very thing that you have hidden from. And that is, you know, the resolution, or that is the start of the resolution of the healing of shame.
It's so interesting that bringing light into that does take away the darkness, and it does seem counterintuitive. I know for me personally, it just seemed like something that was going to my grave. It was never going to be something that would be talked about openly. And then once finding that I wasn't alone, and that's actually the title of our very first podcast, is You're Not Alone, and realizing the power of the body of Christ, but also just the body of other people that have walked this road before, and realizing that, hey, I'm not the only broken person out there.
Well, yeah. And I mean, so again, talking with other people and, you know, the nature of it being where we feel like we're so alone. I mean, you know, the research showing that 70% of men are watching porn, 30% of women now. I mean, that's a very huge statistic. And that, you know, the numbers that are spent, that a research project that was undertaken showed that every second, $2 million is spent on pornography.
Wow.
25% of all search engine requests are pornography related. That means a quarter. One-fourth of all search engine requests are pornography related. now, you know, porn sites get more visitors each month than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined.
Wow.
So, yeah, I said that. Porn sites get more visitors each month than Netflix, Amazon, and Twitter combined. So, you know, as much as this sort of weird phenomena that goes on, that shame is that I feel like I'm the only one doing this. I mean, I know I'm not the only one that supports the porn industry. And yet there is a sense that, like, wow, I feel very alone in this. And who do I tell them? Who do I talk to? And yet when we look at the numbers, the data is so compelling to say, you know, there are obviously a lot of people that are looking and struggling, and that the shame is healed by telling your story and telling safe safe people your story and learning how to tell it over and over again, to safe people, not just anybody, but find. And a lot of times those come in the form of recovery groups like Castamonia.
And I think that's so interesting that's the nature of how the addiction cycle goes, that we do feel like we're the only one driving the pornography industry, or we're the only one doing this. It seems like there are certain issues and certain sins that in our minds or in society are weighted heavier. And this one just seems like it's just a heavier weighted. It's a little darker of a sin than some of the other ones. So, for instance, in a men's group, it may be easier to talk about how we struggle with jealousy, and we can talk about that openly, but we're not going to talk about struggling with pornography, because that's a little harder to share, even though 70% of the guys in that room, mm-hmm. according to stats, are probably struggling with that very same thing.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, in what, you know, that we talked about one of the aspects, which is, you know, just wanting to stop and really wanting something better. And I know many nights, many times, I would ask myself, why me? Why am I the one that feels like I'm in that percentage of guys that is now labeled a sex addict, which, you know, those percentages range all kinds of things from 10 to 30%. But why me? So I guess the question is there something predisposed within me that would make, are there characteristics that predispose someone to sexual addiction?
Well, predispose in the sense of, I mean, to me, the predisposition things are nothing from a genetic standpoint or anything like that. But there are things that are that have created us. I mean, I think any addiction is that there is some element of emotional damage that somebody gravitates towards. And so whether we call it full-fledged trauma or not, but there is some kind of emotional pain that is existing underneath the surface that men have to be willing to engage in. And usually that's, you know, 3 to 6 months after a guy starts real recovery that he can actually look at and start and get some sobriety under his belt, and that he can begin looking at some of the other things. Sometimes they're blatant, explicit things like physical abuse. Sometimes the more subtle things like emotional abuse that are hard to measure, hard to look at. In Christian circles, a lot of times folks grew up with spiritually abusive messages, things that were conveyed to us that did a lot of damage, and people have a hard time shaking these things. So those are things that I think are the predispositional factors that lead a man into that.
What about the aspect of kind of what you were talking about? It seemed like you were discussing a little bit of the compartmentalization that men have, that there's the ability, okay, these things need to go under the rug. I'm not supposed to talk about this, or being able to put certain things in certain boxes. And we know that guys like to compartmentalize and put, you know, different aspects of their life in boxes. But there's some stuff in there that needs to be cleaned out. It's time mm-hmm. to have a garage sale, so to speak, and get some of that out. Is that a characteristic that's more true of, you know, sex addicts, or is that just more true to men in general, the compartmentalization?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, granted, men do compartmentalize. Like one of my therapists that I work with, Shannon, introduced me to a book several years ago. I never read the book, but I always loved the title, you know, that men are like TV dinners and women are like spaghetti, something like that. Maybe it's the other way around. Women are like spaghetti, men are like TV
dinners.
Yeah,
that's the way.
Okay, and you know, so you can create that image in your head there to understand that, yes, men, that we have a tendency to compartmentalize and, you know, go to work, go to church every week, take care of our family, and then feel as if the nature of this issue around pornography or some other aspect of sexual acting out, whatever that looks like, it's not affecting anybody, and believe that it can be accomplished. And yep, I can live my life both ways. I can have both my addiction and I can have a good, healthy life, family life over here, spiritual life. And you know, that's just a big deception. And eventually it comes crashing down at some point. Something bursts that bubble and reflects that it was just not possible to do that nearly as well as men will think it can.
I truly thought I could have a Mr. Hyde and a Dr. Jekyll and they would both live in the same city and be okay. But like you said, it's true that those two worlds get too close and come crashing down, because I think it's not how we're designed to be. I think that, you know, God's created us to be one person that's an authentic person and not live as Mr. Hyde for part of the day.
Absolutely.
So I think that's interesting. What do you say to somebody who just realizes that he can't stop, but he's just decided this is who I am? There came a point when I was deep in my addiction where I got tired of wanting better. I got tired of the wanter being on all the time, and it was just time to turn off the machine and just say, you know what? This is as good as Doug gets, and it's not great, but it's who I am. So what do you say to that guy?
You know, a lot of men give up along the way. They feel as if they have, you know, they have done everything they can. They've read a book, or they've told their pastor, or they've done a purity Bible study or something. And it's like, yeah, I've done it all. But I can just say, I've never met anybody that couldn't ultimately receive healing from this. But it does require, some of it is just immense hard work. And, you know, the first thing I would just say to a man who I would want to know, has he actually told his story to the degree that he risks feeling shame? Because most men will start out and they'll tell their story in a way that doesn't actually risk enough. And until a man risks enough that they will feel embarrassed or shame about it, then they will not get healing.
Okay, so dig more into that. Now I get to play the role of counselor and say that.
And you're doing a great job too, I want to.
So what does that look like? I mean, how would you explain that even deeper? Like, how would I go somewhere to want to feel the shame?
Well, nobody wants to, you don't go at something saying, I want to feel shame today. Who wants to feel that? But you want to reveal yourself. You want to open up yourself. You want to practice enough transparency that somebody has the opportunity to either accept or reject you. And I would just say, get into a group of men who already have an established history that there's nothing that you're going to say that's going to surprise or shock them. And if your church has a group that practices extreme rigorous honesty, I love that term in 12-step world, the recovery community, because people that really practice great recovery, they take that even more serious. I find that guys that know nothing about Christianity, but they know plenty about recovery, they will practice that level of rigorous honesty even greater than, or place a higher premium upon it than I find that most men will in church. But for the listener, the average listener that's paying attention to this today, I would say find a place. If it's at your church, quite honestly, I don't see a lot of those. It requires going to a group where the whole idea is that I'm going to talk about very significant things that are deep down inside, lodged down inside, and I want to tell my story, and I need to tell my story. And to know that if you don't really tell your story, you'll never receive genuine, genuine healing.
The image I just got was that if the shame doesn't come out, and I'm picturing through speaking, then the shame is still in, and that's not a good place for it to be.
Yeah, putting words to those feelings and those experiences, that is your avenue for getting out of this. So groups like Castimony are tremendous. having other discussions afterwards with other grateful followers who are in recovery, who are willing to tell their story over coffee and share what is actually those deep down dark things that a man is holding on to.
And I think that's the scariest part. That's the scary step that if I was listening to this podcast 2 years ago, would scare me the most about being emotionally vulnerable. That's hard for guys in general, but I think it's especially hard for an addict. Because, you know, I would read books like Every Man's Battle, and I'm not knocking the book, but you read the book and it doesn't cure you. So then you feel like you're hopeless. You feel like you can't be helped. And so again, it has to go beyond just taking that alone and finding help out there. And again, you know, shameless plug here. If you need help and you're looking for ways to get resources to you, or you just have some questions that need to be asked, or, you know, hopefully we can find those answers for you, you can email us at puritypodcast@castamonia.org. Well, we can help find resources in your area, or if at all possible, just help you get those answers. Because again, you can't walk this alone, and you're not alone. And that's the true joy in this, is finding others that have walked the road with you and will continue to do so.
So what is that email again?
Puritypodcast@castamonia.org.
How do you spell castamonia?
C-A-S-T-I-M-O-N-I-A.
Okay, so the email again is?
Puritypodcast@castamonia.org.
Okay.
And so obviously the Houston Center of Christian Counseling is here in the Houston area and the Katy area, Sugarland, and we're going to have their website in our show notes and on the website, and our email is also there. But again, if you're listening to this, you may be, you know, all across the world, and that's great. We want you to find help and healing. So, again, just know that it's by looking out for others that are able to listen and be able to accept you and accept that vulnerability. And I think stereotypically it's a sad place where we are, where we realize that's not always church. It's not always the church buildings. I know that I've grown up in some churches and been a part of some churches where I could never have talked about this without being shunned. And it's a sad place. So if you're in that place, or that's your view of church, it's not everywhere. It's not every church. Have any thoughts to that? Like, how do you know, where are we on today's church?
Yeah, I would just say that, so, you know, many men go to other 12-step fellowships. They're not as fortunate as the folks in Houston that have a group like Castamonia. It has how many, 10 groups now?
About 10 groups in the Houston area.
Okay, and but, you know, that they go to an SAA meeting or an SA meeting around the country, and those are on the web, you can find that with a Google search, and those are great starts, and men get some immense help there, and they're like churches in that they all have personalities. So if you go to one and don't like it, go for another one. I'll tell you that most people never like going their first experience, or, you know, I'll say 80% of men don't like their first experience going to a meeting like this, because it's so vulnerable and such a uncomfortable experience to talk about something you've never talked about. So I never anticipate a man will feel good about his first experience. But over time, to give it 3 to 5 times and see what starts transpiring, and start seeing if some of that shame doesn't begin a process of melting and taking less and less control over a man's life. And that's what my hope is for everybody that's listening to this, that you will get the help, that you can have it, that you can experience it, and that you deserve it, and your family and your marriage, and it can be better than anything you've ever anticipated or hoped for, or believed that you can have. And don't stay stuck. Don't stay there. There is help out there.
I think that's great advice. And I think that's a good place to kind of start to draw close to this podcast, is not staying stuck. And again, Tim, I just appreciate your time in doing this. I've twisted Tim's arm into doing one mini podcast with us that'll be released at the same time. One of the things that Tim and I both share in common is just a love for books, and a love for recovery books has become a part of my life recently. It's just I've fallen in love with being able to read all that's out there on sex addiction, and you know, I continue to do so. So I thought it'd be good to have a resource podcast, and so we'll have podcast number 8 will be dedicated just to some book titles. It won't be an exhaustive list. It'll just be a quick conversation about some books that are out there. If you're like, I don't even know where to turn to, you can pull up Amazon and order a few books or audiobooks and start to try to get some information and some help. So again, that'll be the very next podcast. It'll be just a short resource for you. And again, thank you, Tim, for your time. And I hope everyone has a great week.